Welcome to the Connect Kindness podcast, where we connect people with organizations to inspire kindness. I'm your host, Crystal Aziz, and I'm joined by my co-host, Tim Evans. In today's episode, we interview Peter Rose, who's the president of the Rockhouse Foundation in Jamaica. The Rockhouse Foundation has been transforming learning environments in the Negril area for over 15 years. Originally focused on the renovation of public primary schools, the foundation broadened its focus to include the Negril Library, and the past 5 years have been concentrated on early childhood education.
Peter shares with us his background and what led him to dedicate his life to helping others. We discuss the challenges that his organization has faced during the pandemic and how they were able to continue to help their communities with their food distribution initiative. We also discuss how the Rockhouse Foundation was able to open their SAB Inclusive School, which pairs typical learners with children with learning disabilities in the same classroom to promote empathy, unity, and acceptance. So without further delay, this is our interview with Peter Rose, the president of the Rockhouse Foundation.
Thank you so much for joining us on the Connect Kindness podcast. Can you share with our listeners, what is the Rockhouse Foundation and what needs do you guys serve?
Great to be here together with you guys. The Rockhouse Foundation was established in 2003, and it pursued a commitment, or it enabled a commitment from the ownership team of the hotel that had been made 10 years prior in 1993 when they bought the hotel, to number one, give the guests a great experience, number two, make sure that the staff shared in the success of the hotel financially and in all other ways, got a fair wage and, you know, benefits and all of that, that we were good stewards of the environment. And to that end, you know, we've been Green Globe certified since 2009. And then for the purposes of this conversation, you know, a meaningful contribution to the community that hosted our business, basically. And that was a pretty ad hoc kind of a response between 93 and 2003. People would come to the hotel, you know, a school would come to the hotel and say, can you donate a computer or whatever, paint a classroom or whatever. Mm-hmm. But ownership team really didn't feel that it was high impact and felt that the only way that we could really sort of move ahead and do things within this sort of region surrounding the hotel was to create a foundation enabling us to raise money overseas and have some intentionality and purpose that we drove to pursue the goals that we had. So to that end, we created the foundation, as I said, in 2003. It was always oriented towards children. And our feeling was that the vehicle that we felt both most comfortable with and felt we could have the greatest impact with was education.
Peter, you have a very interesting story, and I'd love if you could share with us, how did you end up running a nonprofit in Jamaica?
As I've often said, I am the least qualified person imaginable to be doing what I'm doing. But maybe the weird combination of things over time, you know, sort of came together to work out all right for me and the foundation in Jamaica. I started a kind of a misguided 10 years on Wall Street as a broker on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. Although you might say that 10 years is a long time to figure out that that's really not your calling in life, but call me slow. I finally figured that out and moved into the nonprofit sector in New York City and ran an organization there for about 15 years. That was doing kind of similar work, working within the public school system in New York City, providing wraparound services for children and families in schools in mostly low-income communities, in all low-income communities. And we created two charter schools with that organization. And then I left there in 2002, and the chairman of the hotel was on my board of directors for that organization. He left when I left, and he asked me about a year later to work with him and help set up the foundation in Jamaica. And that kind of kicked things off down there.
That's amazing. Just our interaction, you seem like a very laid back guy. And I can't imagine Peter on the floor of Wall Street. Were you a different person?
I don't think I really was all that different, and that's maybe why it was a misguided 10 years. You know? I know that, you know, it signaled to me that this maybe wasn't what I should be doing for the rest of my life. When I would, you know, commute in on the train every morning, and the business page in the paper was the last one that I went to. You know, it was almost anything before that. So, I enjoyed my time down there. I met a lot of good people, and at the end of the day, a lot of generous people who have supported work that we've done both in New York and to some extent down in Jamaica. So, you know, everything sort of pulls together. Everything pulls together if you kind of make it pull together, you know?
Absolutely.
See, that's the cool thing about life, right? You can do whatever you want to, right? Once you're...
You got to keep your eyes open and see what opportunities are there, right?
Exactly. So reeling back to the foundation, you guys have a school called the SAV Inclusive that you guys built with the Rock House Foundation. Can you tell us why this school specifically is unique, not only in Jamaica, but also across the world?
And it's also unique to the foundation in the sense that over the course of our, you know, closing in on 20-year history, most of what we've done is renovate, expand, modernize, improve existing schools within the ministry. That is, you know, basically public schools in Jamaica. And this school is the first school, SAV Inclusive, or the Savannah Lamar Inclusive Infant Academy, known as SAV Inclusive, is the first school that we created, conceived, built from the ground up or below the ground up. And it came out of a conversation that I had actually with a staff member at Rock House Hotel who lamented the fact that it had taken her several years just to get a diagnosis of severe autism for her son, at vast expense, at least, you know, relative to her income anyway. And then basically was told that now that she had the diagnosis, there were really no services to speak of in the western part of the island that she could access for her son. Wow. And that was about 10 years ago, maybe a little less than 10 years ago. And we had kind of three projects in the pipeline already, but it just really stuck with me. Through those projects. And as we were winding down on the last one, I began to think about, you know, how we could pursue the need to provide services for children with special needs in the western part of the island. And it just made sense the more that we thought about it, you know, to create a school. And it was very clear that in creating a school, that the best opportunity that we could provide for all children in the school was to do a full inclusion mixed ability model where, you know, children with special needs, typical learners, were learning side by side in the same classroom. And that, you know, that's unusual anywhere in the world. And it's unique in Jamaica. The Ministry of Education was sort of conceptually behind it, but unfamiliar with the practice and the approach. And so it took, you know, some time to persuade the right people that this was a worthwhile ambition and, you know, to get the co-stakeholders on board. And principally, I'm talking about the Ministry of Education. It's not conceptually not any reluctance, just sort of understanding what it really entailed and what the long-term support requirements were going to be and all that. But they came on board in 2015. You know, we developed the concept, we got the location, we worked with an architect to create the physical, you know, to develop the plans for the physical plant, and then started construction in 2016. In the summer of 2016, opened the doors in 2017 with the first cohort of 33-year-olds. So, you know, it's been a bit of a saga, which, you know, I think anything really sort of worthwhile pursuing often is a bit of a saga. Mm-hmm. And now we have 128 students in grade age 3 through first grade, and the school ultimately will be pre-K, that is age 3, straight through high school on the same location, same approach, multiple adults and much in classrooms with a much lower number of students. We cap out between 15 and 20. And throughout, throughout the process, children with special needs, regardless of what they are, whether they're physical, developmental, or a combination of the two, are in the same classroom with typical learners. Well, I could go on and on, so I won't say one final point, but a significant point is the stigma that so many people around the globe have towards children with special needs. Is especially prominent, I think, in Jamaica. So the challenge really was to get parents of typical learners to feel comfortable enrolling their children in a school that they initially perceived as one for children with special needs. And, there was hesitancy, we did outreach, we had, meetings with prospective parents and so forth. And at the end of the day, it's really the children teaching the parents not to be, prejudiced against children with special needs.
Yeah.
And it's been a beautiful thing to behold over these, 4 years, to watch as you can see the sort of hesitancy and the skepticism of parents, the new parents as they come in. And gradually, they just embrace all the children in the school. And, it's not children that are born with stigma against children who don't look like them. It's obviously adults that convey that to them. So,
I mean, that's
an important collateral benefit.
Yeah, that's powerful. Not only the typical learners. Being around the kids with special needs, they learn empathy, they learn acceptance, and that's so important. Those are things that will be with you for the rest of your life, and then that you'll pass down generation to generation. I'm sure
and that you could argue we're in quite short supply right now.
Yep, absolutely, absolutely.
Anything to expand.
For sure. I'm interested to learn about the enrollment process, because I assume that the demand to be in the school is pretty high. So how do you select the people who are able to attend the school?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's a little bit controversial in the beginning as we implemented the procedure. One of the critical things for the foundation, long before this school, but just as a basic principle of our philosophy is equity. And, in so many countries around the world where resources are slim, it's the people with contacts that generally get the most resources.
Yeah.
And so we felt that it was really important for us to create a system whereby, it wasn't somebody who knew somebody who knew somebody or whatever that could get their child enrolled, because as you point out, once people were aware of it, and I don't, mean to sort of sound trite about it, but build it and they will come. And it's an especially, beautiful physical facility, and that sort of captivates people from the get-go. But we felt that the only way to proceed and make sure that there was equity for everyone was to do a lottery, because the demand was so much greater than the seats that we had to fill. And that was the case in the first year, and that's only gotten more and more and more as people are more and more aware of the school and the benefits for both children with special needs and typical learners. So we do a lottery, and the only sort of exemption from the lottery is any sibling of a child currently enrolled is automatically admitted if they want to come.
I'm just going to relate to a lottery story really quickly. Whenever I was transitioning from fifth grade to sixth grade in New York in the Bronx, right? There was a school called Meriton. This was a school that, you know, for a kid from the Bronx, if they could get into Meriton, they know that they would be sent all the way through high school in a way, because it was just one of those schools that was really funded well. They had so many opportunities, but you had to be in like the top five students in your school to even get drawn into that lottery, right? So I remember my parents putting this pressure, like, be good, you know, this is a good opportunity. Like, I was already pretty good at school. And so I busted my butt, and I made sure that I was like the smartest in the school. I did everything I could possibly do. We get to the night of the lottery, my parents are sitting there, and I'm like, man, I really hope it. I'm sitting around my friends, you know, and then my name did not get called. And that was a huge factor in my parents' decision in my life. Like, do we stay in the Bronx knowing that should be going to, you know, under par school, or what do we do at this point? And I think people will look at not getting that lottery as something just devastating and terrible. And maybe there's other families that are listening that went through the lottery process, but they didn't get in right away. But I think it actually propelled me as a student to, I'm going to be successful no matter where I go, right? So you can't be discouraged by the lottery process at all either. I just think it just makes it a fair playing ground.
That's so important to hear a personalized story about the experience of being on the other end of not being admitted.
Yeah.
And obviously there was that, you know, famous documentary of whatever it was, Search and Superman or whatever, about the lottery system in New York City itself. Mm-hmm. And both the joy and the devastation that, you know, that families experience when they're either successful or not successful. And you know, you touch on the on why it's controversial from our standpoint and from the parent's standpoint, right? The other thing is that there's lower sort of faith in Jamaica in systems and the fairness of systems. And even when you set something up, that's specifically targeted towards creating equity, it still is, you know, is sort of viewed with what's the scam behind this, you know? Mm-hmm. All right, so what's the real deal, you know? And that's been something that you know, we've taken pains to help people understand why we're doing it this way. And it was you know, candidly, it was difficult the first year, and it's gotten no less difficult from the standpoint of families who don't get in and their disappointment, but from the standpoint of at least understanding the concept and why we do it that way, I think there's general appreciation for that, because people are so accustomed, you know, to sort of taking a backseat to those with connections and contacts of some kind.
It's all about what you tell your kids, right? So it's if you tell them this is putting you down, this is setting you back because you didn't get in, or you speak to them and say, you're going to be successful no matter where you go and what you do, and you can always keep on trying, you know? So I guess having that mindset too, whether you get in or you don't, but just speaking very highly to your kids and keeping them motivated, I think is very important.
Yeah. No doubt. No doubt.
So I know that you guys have an amazing vision of fairness, unique classrooms, whatnot. I guess, can you go into a little bit more of your vision moving forward for the Rockhouse Foundation? What does that look like?
You know, if we were having this conversation 2 years ago, pre-pandemic, mm-hmm. that would be a different kind of conversation. You know, now that we're a year into the pandemic, or a little more than a year into the pandemic, the future is a little bit easier to see the blurry outlines of, and so it helps us sort of think through, you know, how we can continue to pursue the things that we've been pursuing, that is improving education generally speaking in the West region and in and around the Negril area. And I think we've spoken in prior conversations about just sort of philosophically our feeling is, you know, we approach the relationships with the schools that we work with as long-term relationships, long-term comprehensive relationships, not a sort of a one-shot infusion of resources to you know, improve a facility or provide for an extra teacher or whatever. But these are long-term relationships that focus on, you know, maintaining the physical plant to the level that, you know, that we created it when we did the renovations and the improvements and so forth. And obviously, in the case of Sav Inclusive, this really quite beautiful, remarkable facility that is highly unusual in the public system in Jamaica. The ambition to create Sav Inclusive as a pre-K through high school is a pretty encompassing ambition, both from the standpoint of the resources required to create, you know, to physically build these, the primary and the secondary campuses, but also, you know, the Ministry of Education in Jamaica is an overburdened, inadequately resourced agency trying to attend to the needs of 300,000 plus students in Jamaica. And that's obviously exacerbated tremendously by the pandemic and the resources that have had to been sort of differently allocated to deal with safety and receive both children and adults. From our standpoint, from the foundation standpoint, pursuing the Sav Inclusive vision to its completion so that we have children from age 3 to age, you know, 17 or 18 who have gone through that entire journey and have benefited no matter what their profile. That's our principal and primary ambition. And equally important, I mean, it might be described as a secondary priority, but it's an equally important priority, is to maintain the relationship with the other network schools that we have, make sure that those physical facilities and the, you know, the educational needs that that each of those schools have are being met. Along the way, to look at other opportunities where we can have high impact in schools that we're not currently serving. The extent to which that we'll be able to sort of add to the number of schools in our network while at the same time pursuing the expansion of Sav Inclusive is a little bit up in the air right now because of the pandemic and really not knowing when we get to the other side, you know, sort of what the donor profile is going to look like and so forth. Also, what the government of Jamaica and what the general economy in Jamaica is going to look like. While the foundation doesn't raise any money in Jamaica because we have access to overseas capital, and we feel, you know, that if we were actively looking to raise money in Jamaica, really what we'd be doing is sort of taking money out of the pockets of other NGOs that don't have access to overseas capital. Yeah. At the same time, you know, we believe in partnership with the Ministry of Education, and particularly in the case of Sav Inclusive, that means, you know, that they fund the teachers and, you know, the food costs and some of the basic operating costs, not to the extent that those needs or not with the resources that those needs require. You know, that's why we supplement to the extent that we do. But generally speaking, in the Western region, we want to continue to be a force for improvement of education, you know, broadly speaking, and then specifically in those partner schools that we're so intensely involved with.
Do you guys think that you'll recreate this school somewhere else? Or do you think this is just a Jamaica thing right now?
I know one thing for sure, which is the Rockhouse Foundation will pursue all of its activities exclusively in Jamaica. You know, that's the focus of where our work will be, is currently and will continue to be, because it is the charitable arm of the Rockhouse and Hotel and Skylark Hotel. And so, you know, it's not like we have any intention or plan of going to, you know, I don't know where, Barbados or something and doing something there. Okay. The concept has been presented to us by the Ministry of Education in Jamaica of facilitating the creation of this kind of a school in each of the parishes across the island. There's a recognition that that this kind of school is an asset to any locality.
Yeah.
And particularly if, as we've done, viewed it as a responsibility to amplify what we're doing within the walls of the school to the broader community, that is by doing outreach and you know, workshops and seminars and that kind of thing for parents and for teachers in the surrounding region. And, you know, that should be the case with any schools that we're able to help create in other parishes across the island in the future.
That's awesome.
Peter, you mentioned, you know, how the pandemic has kind of changed everything, you know, for everyone. Yet the Rock House Foundation, you guys have found a way to continue growing. Can you tell us about your food distribution initiative and what's involved with that?
As was the case for really the entire world, there was a moment in time roughly a year ago where things just shut down without warning, at least to the average person. And when that happened, you know, like everybody, we were sort of scrambling, trying to figure out what that meant for our children and families and what that meant for how we could continue to support them. And, you know, it started, the food distribution concept started in the simplest way, really, which was at Sav Inclusive, we had a bunch of extra food in storage, you know, in anticipation of school continuing, just like everybody else, and thought, well, at the very least, let's distribute that out to the families because, you know, they need it now more than ever. In Jamaica, children, and particularly children from the most challenged communities throughout the island, get most of their nutrition at school, either in a combination of breakfast feeding programs and lunch or just lunch. And so that food insecurity that was created instantaneously by the shutdown, we thought, you know, we could mitigate to some, at least minimal, you know, to a minimal extent anyway, in the one school. And then it really just occurred to us, this was probably the most impactful thing that we could do moving forward. And so we created a GoFundMe campaign for the foundation specifically targeted to food insecurity at our four schools. Really bottom line here is that over time, over these, whatever it is, 18 years now, there's just a very loyal and incredibly generous donor base that has continued to support the work that we do in Jamaica. And you know, we went back to the well and they were incredibly generous and they funded the food distribution program for what we thought was probably going to be 2 or 3 months at the time, just like everybody else, you know, things are going to return to normal soon. Here we are a year later. So we determined that we would do it, you know, until school started up again. And that obviously became a kind of a rolling proposition. And so in that was in March, we did that GoFundMe in March through about May. And that, you know, as I say, adequately funded us for probably four or five months. And then we decided we needed to just continue it. And so we did another GoFundMe at the end of last calendar year that was both targeted towards food distribution, but also at the ongoing needs of all the schools, both the physical, you know, when a school is not in operation, it almost takes more of a beating than when it is in operation in a funny way. Mm-hmm. So the ongoing maintenance needs and repair needs and all of that, we obviously needed to address as well. And so we were able to, again, this incredibly loyal donor base came through. And
we talked to a lot of nonprofits, and one of their biggest challenges is fundraising. And it sounds like you've done a great job of finding, you know, loyal loyal donors. What advice would you give to those those nonprofits who are trying to achieve, you know, what you have achieved?
It's a good question. I think that all organizations sort of have their own, you know, idiosyncratic kind of profile and universe of donors and other stakeholders. And we're no different. There's obviously sort of universally kind of conventional ways of raising money through individuals and foundations and so forth. And in that previous experience that I had in New York City, it was a much more conventional, we pursued a much more conventional approach with foundations and largely funded through foundations. The Rock House Foundation has this incredible sort of constellation of assets at its disposal, which makes it very fortunate. And so it makes it harder to say, you know, here are some of the universal things you can do, because our situation is in and of itself so highly idiosyncratic. And when I say that, by that I mean that ownership team in one form or another also has connections to a music and dinner venue in New York that we use every year for our benefit, and we get that at no cost. We have connections to restaurants in New York City, and two restaurants in New York City. Same restaurant is also branded at one of the hotels in the Grill, but there's also another one in Dubai. They, you know, that again, that sort of connection to those opens up an array of potential donors. We have, you know, we probably have 100,000 people on a combined list between the hotels and the restaurants. Wow. Yeah. So obviously that kind of anchors our fundraising in a lot of ways. And I'll say just selfishly that, you know, I spend a lot of time and effort in that previous organization raising funds to keep to keep the doors open, so to speak. And in a way, you know, it sort of takes you away from looking at what you want to do in the future and thinking more strategically in the out years. And that may, I mean, look, you know, that may say more about how that I ran that that operation, but the fundraising is just an ongoing, perpetual, everyday need. And we're very fortunate at Rock House that, you know, we can spend more time focused on the things that we know need attention in Jamaica than on just thinking where's the next dollar coming where. And it's not to say that it comes, you know, without effort, and that we don't you know, cultivate and communicate with and respond to our donors, but it is not the just all-consuming kind of activity that it is for so many others. And I have, you know, great empathy for all nonprofits that, you know, for which it is such a, you know, a daily struggle.
That is such a blessing, because that truly is the number one thing that Tim and I encounter when we speak with the nonprofits. And it's something that we are going to strive over the next few years with Connect Kindness to try and figure out a way. You know, we're helping on the marketing side right now with doing these podcasts, putting them on our social media, putting them on our website, linking everybody directly to the organizations. But fundraising is going to be the next move for us on how we can help the nonprofits that we speak with. So great job with everything that you guys do, because it truly is amazing.
Well, you know, think about it also, Crystal, in the sense that it's not our sole source of stakeholder. Mm-hmm. Guests coming to the hotel, but it's a significant source of stakeholder, right? So they, you know, and we do this obviously quite intentionally, that we provide the opportunity for any guest that wants to go visit one of the schools while they're at either one of the hotels. Every week we do a trip to the hotels, and to the school, one of the schools, and it obviously gives those people the opportunity not to just sort of in the abstract donate to something that they think, yeah, this must be a good thing, but to actually see the results of their generosity. And I think that's an incredibly important thing, whether you have to do it virtually and, you know, in whatever ways you have to do it, is to draw the connection, you know, to the thing and to make the gap between what you say that you're doing and what you're actually doing as narrow as possible. That to me is sort of the definition of success as a, well, kind of in all aspects of life, but certainly in the nonprofit sector.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Definitely keep that in mind.
Can you share a success story that sticks out in your mind?
You know, there's several of them. I mean, there's a number of them as I think about it. Our very first project was the Negril Primary School. You know, kind of logically, half a mile or so from Rockhouse Hotel, right in our backyard. So we decided that, and it was in just like mind-numbingly bad condition, and just, you know, felt like that should be the place we should go first. When we did that project, we had the process for us is that we spent quite a bit of time in dialogue with the school community that we're proposing to work with. So we find out what their priorities are, not to sort of impose what we perceive as their priorities on them, obviously. And in doing that, it was conversation with, you know, school board, school leaders, parents, and students. And we met a bunch of students at the time. One of the most impressive students that we met is now an employee at Skylark. And, you know, she came to a job fair when we were first opening that hotel, just like hundreds of other people, and, you know, was instantaneously one of the most impressive. And nobody knew when they were hiring her. And, you know, one day I walked into the lobby after we opened up, and there she was. And I was like, what? You know, Talia, what are you doing here? You know, it was just it was one of those just, you know, things that you could never imagine or predict or whatever. And there it is, you know, kind of as a in your face affirmation of the things that, you know, happened long ago, but obviously, you know, had some enduring impact. There's a young man I've known both Talia and this other young man who is at Little Bay all age, since he was probably in fourth or fifth grade. He's about 20, 22 or three now. And he does all of the signage at all of our schools now, and does a lot of the sort of technology support for us. He's just a brilliant kid who's got many, many talents. And, you know, so it's not a lifelong relationship, obviously, with all of the students. Life happens and they move and, you know, whatever, things happen. But the ability to have this sustained relationship with the communities with which we work also provides the opportunity to have sustained relationships with individuals within those communities and, you know, sort of see how life unfolds for them after they, you know, finish their time with one of our schools.
And you get to see it come full circle, right? That doesn't happen very often. So to be able to see that, it must be awesome.
It's incredible, you know, and the young man that I referenced, you know, his involvement is exclusively with the foundation. So he sort of, you know, benefited in the early days and now is coming back and contributing back to it. So, it, you know, that's as full circle as you could possibly hope for.
If there was one piece of advice that you could give to anyone in life, it could be about the foundation. It could be about your time on Wall Street. It could just be about your childhood. It doesn't matter what it is. This is your defining moment. What would you like to share?
You know, to me, that's a very straightforward thing. Things don't come to you in life. You have to go to them. If you want something, whatever that is, if it's the simplest thing, you know, if you need groceries, you have to go to the grocery store. If you want to build a school for children with special needs and typical learners, you have to, you know, come up with the concept, do the work, do the underlying work, and suffer the you know, the frustrations and the delays and the, you know, skepticism and all of that. The concept of, you know, what will be is, on the one hand, there's some truth to that. But in my view, we have influence over what happens, not only to us in our own lives, but the impact that we have on others. And to be mindful of that, and to understand that, you know, the only way that things happen in life the way you want them to happen is by you pursuing them with that, you know, with intentionality.
That deserves a few snaps.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whoa, hold on. So I got 100%. One trigger and one snap. That's good. I don't know. I don't know how that relates to, you know, all your other interviewees.
I love that. I've really enjoyed our interview, Peter. And for our listeners who want to get involved with the Rock House Foundation, how can they get in touch with the organization?
If, you know, the first thing to do is to go to www.rockhousefoundation.org. And to familiarize yourself with the things that we do and how we do them and so forth. But anybody can reach out directly to me at info@rockhousefoundation.org. And I'll respond, you know, personally to any inquiries about how to support, or just, you know, if people want more information or whatever. And they can also access all the information about the foundation, not surprisingly, on both of the hotel websites. That is Rockhouse Hotel at rockhousehotel.com, and there's a link directly to the foundation. And Skylark is skylarknegril.com, also a link directly to the foundation. And then we're on Facebook and Instagram as well, at Rockhouse Foundation. So any and all of those ways, and I'd recommend the website first. And as I say, anybody can reach out at any time at info@rockhousefoundation.org.
Peter, thank you so much. This has been a pleasure. I have so many more questions, so we may have to have you back on the podcast. So it's been a pleasure, and thank you so much for your time and sharing the amazing things that Rockhouse Foundation are doing in Jamaica.
Well, I could say the same thing in return. You know, it's so important to draw connections between organizations that are, you know, struggling along to try to do things, particularly during this extraordinarily difficult period of the pandemic. And you guys reaching out is, we're grateful for that, and look forward to a long-standing relationship.
Always.
Thank you so much for listening to the Connect Kindness podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram @ShareGiveDo. And please remember, the world is changed by your example, not by your opinion.